Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 15 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and a different guest go through the 1973 British cult horror classic The Wicker Man, one section at a time. I am joined in this week's episode by Andy Nelson. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me to talk about this movie.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to be on. So yeah, we're going to get into your John Fox of The Wicker Man shortly, but before we get started with that, this will be a description of the scene in question that we're going to be talking about. Following on from the last one, we get a continuation of the procession going through Summer Island towards the Stone Circle, where the fire dance was performed earlier on in the film, where we see a game being played with the swords, following on from the sword dance saw earlier. It's in a game where each resident of the Summer Isle goes into the Stone Circle, the swords are loaded down around them, and it's a question of whether or not they'll get their head chopped off.
Fun game,
yeah. You definitely don't want to be the loser in that one.
Right.
No or kidding. For something to go wrong, because find out that is the whole thing was a game, and it's designed in a way so that no one gets hurt during it.
Right.
So get that little bit of laughter, see some of their sacrifices, so sacrificing some beer to the ocean, which for Scotland, that's a truly devastating sacrifice.
Well, it's either truly devastating or it's really showing your commitment to be willing to let all that wonderful ale go, right?
And then we go on to the discussion of the more serious sacrifice. And this is the first time in the film where we actually see Rowan Morrison in person. And then how he, in the Mr. Punch costume, goes up to the people holding Rowan, punches on out in the scene that was made irrevocably worse than the Nicolas Cage version. And then there's a little chase through the caves on Summer Isle, and then when Howie gets to the end of it, we get the big reveal of this section of the film and the big twist of the film that Rowan was in on it, and the whole thing was a ploy specifically to lure Howie to that location at that time. Next week's episode, we'll go in more detail about the exact nature of it and the full reveal of why Howie was chosen and all nature of that. But here, it's that we get that initial gut punch that it was all a plan. And so dive in to talk about this section of the film, Andy, what's your general thoughts on your history with The Wicker Man?
I mean, it's a film I really enjoy because it creates such an interesting horror film that is very jovial. Like, it creates this sense of place that that is creepy in and of itself, because everybody in this place is like in this same kind of cultish mentality, which you don't really, I mean, you kind of sense a little bit as how he's kind of poking around and trying to figure out what is going on here, but it just builds this kind of sense of dread. And so I don't know, I when I first saw this, which, I mean, you know, was I don't know, probably sometime in college, it was one of those films that hadn't crossed my radar until, I don't know, somebody probably in film school was talking about it at some point. And I don't know, it was one of those horror films that piqued my curiosity, and because of all of these different things. And so I think it was one of those films that I watched, and I don't know, it was one that it just kind of sticks with you because it has kind of that creepy tone to it. And because the tone is so positive you know, flowery, you know, I mean, it's very that folksy sense of the community is, you can see why there's this interesting appeal to it, but you don't realize how frightening and terrifying it can actually be when, like, the entire community is working against you. And so I think that's why I find it so effective. And it's a film that I've revisited a number of times since then, and I always find it more and more effective every time. And having looked at the Nicolas Cage version, you know, it's like, I think I will just stick with this one. You know, I think this is the one that really stands out as the one to check out.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing I think of in terms of the best way to describe the differences in tone and feel between the two different versions is that the original's funny on purpose, the remake's funny accidentally.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, throw Nicolas Cage in there. And it's one of those things where I feel like they probably could have found ways to do it. It's just, it's a shame because I don't, like, clearly they were trying to answer questions that you could, I can see why people would be asking with this film, but at the same time, I think one of the reasons that it's so effective is because it doesn't have all of those answers. And when you start getting these, you know, setups of like, oh, this child was actually, you know, Nicolas Cage's kid and all this stuff, it's like, yeah. Oh, wow, they're really going to some extreme lengths to try setting this whole thing up in ways that it just doesn't need to, because I think the unknown of so many things going on in it make it work all the better.
It's the whole feel of the horror of the not knowing what's there. And so yeah. The remake, it explains too much, and in some ways it detracts from the power of the film and actual story through explaining it too much, like having, you know, missing being Nicolas Cage's daughter in the remake. And we got that, and then boom, one of the reasons why Howie was chosen as a sacrifice, that's gone.
The best thing that came out of that film is the fact that it made me appreciate the bees joke in Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent that much more. I don't know, just like if Nicolas Cage can laugh at himself and some of that stuff, then that's all right.
Yeah, again, I think I've mentioned in front of this podcast, there is a good way to do a modern day version of The Wicker Man. And you can kind of see that in stuff in like the A24 elevated horror. Even those ones, there's still a unique feel and tone of The Wicker Man that none of the other kind of folk horror films have ever fully captured.
I would think like Midsommar is probably the closest that I have found something creating that same sort of community and vibe, where it's creating this community of people that these people are invited to. And you do kind of get a sense of that. You don't really understand exactly what's going on here. You know, Florence Pugh's character goes through this character journey. And I think that's probably the closest. But I also think that the tone in that one is a little bit more overt and designed to be a little more straightforward. I absolutely love that film. But there is something so unsettling about just the nature of this community in this film. Like, it really feels witchy, you know? It really just feels like there's something else going on here.
Yeah, and then also what I find works well about Wicker Man, I think, it's like, Midsommar really got was, like, in Midsommar, you can tell it's all, like, more isolated, rural. It feels otherworldly, whilst most of the stuff in Wicker Man, it feels fairly normal, but with a few little hidden bits that if you're not necessarily looking for it, you may not notice if you're just visiting. Like, it's not like it's ordinary, like post office, pharmacy, library, those kind of like facilities that you'd see in an ordinary English village or Scottish village in this instance.
Right.
And it's that kind of ordinariness of certain aspects of Summer Isle which helps make it feel a bit more unnerving.
Right, and I think that's a great point about the differences there, because this one, you know, ostensibly is about a police officer investigating in a small town. And so it feels very much like, okay, I know where this story is going. And with Midsommar, it's like, well, okay, they're out in the middle of the woods and they end up with this strange commune. So yeah, something unsettling is going to happen here, because it's like they're isolated and they can't get out.
Yeah, and it's explicitly a religious ritual.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So this one does feel very much like it's the real world and things are just off. It's like something that you get in, you know, films where there's large group of people possessed or something, like, you know, I'm thinking of like something like John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, where all the people working in the church are like the scientists and the religious experts and everything are working in this church, but slowly, like, all these homeless people from the community suddenly just start surrounding the place and just stare. They just stand there and stare, and it's like that group possession that I find so unnerving. And that's something here that but it's different, because it's like everybody acts normal. I mean, normal to a certain extent, but they're
relatively
acting like normal villagers, right?
Yeah, I think it's like in most instances, of the film. They feel like it's normal, like having a sing along in the pub or just seeing like a school lesson and or like people visiting the library. It's ones where out of if you don't know the context and you actually just see stuff like with no sound, you'd think it is something fairly normal. It's only when you actually dig deeper into it that you start to see the undercurrents of menace and suspense in the community.
Right.
And I mean, that's why I probably think that's, and it's a deliberate choice from the director of that one, but the closest film I think of that's managed to get that kind of tone in, has been Hot Fuzz.
Right.
And then we had Wright and, you know, casting Edward Woodward in Hot Fuzz. It's a fairly a deliberate choice.
Yes, absolutely. Like
a deliberate homage.
Yep. It's so much fun the way that he, I mean, it's a great example because it really is taking that cult in a small village sort of community. And everybody's kind of, not everybody, but you know, there's a certain contingency of the community that is really in on what's going on and they have, their own malicious intent. So yeah, it's a very fun one.
And this, you know, definitely so how Edgar Wright is a massive fan of the Wicker Man. Even recently, a few weeks ago at time of recording, Pitch House Central Cinema in London did a 50th anniversary screening of The Wicker Man on the 1st of May. And Edgar Wright, I'm not sure, I don't know if he was like, did one of the guests doing like a talk on it or if he was just in the audience, but he was definitely there for it.
Oh, well, that would be a great way to go see that one, yeah, for sure.
In a few weeks from the time of recording, cinemas in the UK, they're going to be doing a full like re-release of the 4K restoration of the final cut of The Wicker Man, and they're going to be including footage of that event in London, which, I've got my ticket booked already.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be so much fun to go see. I'd love to see this on the big screen.
And even though it's not the 1st of May, it feels right that it's the summer solstice.
Yeah, right? Yeah. There's those certain days where, it does feel right when it's something like summer solstice or, I mean, it could have been winter solstice, but any of those sorts of days would just feel right for this movie.
So, yeah, then actually getting into this section of the film, I think start off with the sword dance, and it's one where you can definitely feel like the ritual aspects of Summer Island, the procession, and how like different aspects of the islands have known and incorporated into their processions and religions. So, like in this instance, it going to the stone circle where we saw the fire leap earlier on in the film, and it feels like it's the right location for doing this kind of ritual, given like the nature of the dance or dance and presentation of it and as the six-pointed star. I'm really interested in how they've incorporated that, the features of the island, into their rituals.
Yeah, and this, I mean, the location for this, you know, just having kind of this Stonehenge, this circle sort of thing, this location here really kind of lends a lot to that sense of the kind of the old world religions, right? Kind of the paganist sort of views, and everything that they're doing here works so well. And it didn't necessarily need to involve a stone circle, but the fact that it is just really enhances that. And I think it gives it a great tone for what they're about to do here. And I mean, even just the fact that it's this weird little procession, you know, and everybody's in their animal heads, and you know, I think it's very funny watching, you know, Sergeant Howie through all of this, where as the one who's disguised in here, like, how is he acting? Is he acting like somebody who kind of knows what he's doing, or is he really kind of acting as somebody who's just like, I hope that they're buying this? Yeah. As he kind of walks up, he's just like, I don't know, waving his little wand back and forth, just like, yeah, okay, I guess I'll just watch and see what's happening. I don't know. I think it's really funny too. I mean, it's interesting. I can imagine I wish that I remembered like the first time I watched this, how I was reading all of this, because clearly, as we will find out in this minute, everybody knows that that's him, right?
Yeah.
Or this 5 minute chunk that we're talking about. And that's what's interesting is like, he doesn't know that. And I wish I could remember, like, if I felt he was really kind of pulling the wool over their eyes. My hunch is that I probably was thinking that he did, and that it was a big surprise when they come out of the cave toward the end of this section.
But yeah, so I think it works well in rewatches where you're thinking how much they're playing along with him, they like knowing it is him, and they're just kind of trolling him in this section. Like when we get to the actual game of the beheading, it's clear on rewatches they want to troll him by having him take part in that section. And putting that extra bit of fear in him that they may cut his head off.
Right. Even the way the Christopher Lee grabs him. By the nose. Which is funny because, I mean, there is that sense that he's about to take his mask off because he's grabbing him that way. But obviously, as we find out, Christopher Lee, his character knows that it is him. And so he's just trying to give him that little... scare that they might be trying to take his mask off here. It plays really well.
And then we actually get into the game itself. First, I really like that little touch of Lord Somerile being the first one to actually take part in it and put his head in the swords.
Yeah.
It's kind of really helps establish how involved he's gotten with the community and with the religion.
Yeah. And I just got to say, I'm always impressed, like when I watch these six men do the little thing with the swords, I'm always impressed that it works the way it does. Like, and I've watched it so many times, I'm like, okay, so they each grab, so a left hand and the right hand, like trying to figure it out. But I don't know. I think it's just such a cool move that they do to create this swords, this pattern with the swords.
Yeah, and it's also one where if it's something not skilled enough, you can easily see like them accidentally cutting their hands off.
Yeah. Right, yeah, it's not exactly the safest game to play for everybody involved.
And also something, I don't know if you noticed it, did you recognize the music that was being played on the bagpipes during the game?
You know, I don't know if I did. What was it?
So it's the nursery rhyme, Oranges and Lemons. So don't know if it's a thing outside the UK, but it's like a fairly well-known nursery rhyme, probably... using other forms of media. So, example, it was used fairly prominently in George Orwell's 1984.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But it's also one where, if you know the nursery rhyme, you can tell how it's playing out, because the last two lines of the nursery rhyme, and an example of how dark nursery rhymes can get, are, "Here comes a candle to light you to bed, here comes a chopper to chop off your head."
That was not a nursery rhyme I knew as a kid, so that's, I'm going to have to look that one up because that's crazy. Although, to your point, nursery rhymes do get very dark, and that's what I think is so interesting about. And the way that, like, I mean, the music incorporated throughout this film has that sort of nursery rhyme tone, those folk songs, kind of that vibe. And you realize that there is so much darkness in them, and I think that that's one of the strengths of the film.
Yeah, and the nursery rhymes, as I mentioned in the previous episode, they've also used Baba Black Sheep in one section. And it works well, like the interplay of like folk songs and nursery rhymes, how you see a lot of roots that nursery rhymes have in traditional folk music. And again, it also specifically works for this one since it is used as a game. Like, outside this context, like, seen like videos or other games played where, like, children in past, like, sung the song and, like, phrase that hands as, like, an arch. And when they get to the last words, they push their hands down over the last person that comes through.
Right. That was like, London Bridge is Falling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that one. But, you actually listen, though, the structure of the nursery rhyme, you can tell exactly when the head chop's going to be and how it plays out, because it's six verses and then the last two lines. And I counted it when I was rewatching this section for prior to recording this podcast, and they get the positioning of the lyrics, the way it's played on the bagpipes, it fits with the pacing of the song. And that's another nice little touch.
It's a great touch, and they set up that scene well, because the line has been going, and the rabbit head that's, you know, right behind Sergeant Howie, or the person with the rabbit head on, the way that they shoot that, you never get a sense that it's like a head on a head. It always just looks like the head, and And so it works really well because you just don't know. I mean, I guess if you are familiar with Oranges and Lemons, you may be, but otherwise it's like, it's kind of a nice surprise that when they actually do pull their swords and slice the head off.
But also if you don't necessarily recognize it the first time round as well, so again, another one that benefits rewatch. But also, I don't know if you notice, if you look in the background, when Howie, just for like how he goes through, you can see the rabbit being led into the right position in the line. So to fit with the rhythm of the song.
Right. Yeah, you can.
Those like little details that really help with rewatching the film and make it such a rewarding experience.
I mean, this is a film that is just rich with detail. You know, like there are just so many things in every scene, whether it's the pub or the rooms or all of this stuff going on here with all the heads that you keep seeing. I mean, it's just, there are always those little details throughout here. Clearly a very well thought out film, the way that they crafted all of this.
But it's, and then also the thing that really works is the, like the reactions we hear from the resident Summer Isle after their heads chopped off. It's like you feel the other resident Summer Isle, you feel like a bit of laughter in them, whilst Howie, there's that shock he has where he genuinely thinks someone's had their head cut off.
Right. Also, that's like you're getting some interesting cutaways over the course of this to like the sun setting, like as the sun's kind of getting lower and lower. And also the it's kind of like the dragon head.
Like the hobby horse.
The hobby horse. Right. Yeah. But the way that its mouth is like bites, like they
like a metronome.
Yes, exactly. And so they play all of this well to kind of really amp the tension through the sequence. But it's in a fun way, and that's what I think is so interesting. It's building like it's a horror movie, but it ends up just being a game.
And you imagine like a lesser film would kind of treat it more like as an actual genuine horror scene rather than having that bit of laughter when we see the person take the costume off. And It feels like it's a sense of honor, and they're clearly all having fun with it. And then we see like later on with Lord Samurai like leading that girl down towards the beach, and there's all this weird sense of fun that the rest of Samurai exudes during that whole section.
Yeah, right. They're all clearly having a great time with it, and it's like after the beheading. It's just kind of fun to look at what Howie is doing because he's so shocked by all of this. And he's just looking around like, I don't know, this is where I think as like that first time viewer, when you're watching him and you know he's disguised, you're wondering if they're going to catch on because he's so obviously not reacting the way that I suppose the rest of them are reacting. But he's like shocked and he runs over to the head that's on the ground to make sure there's not an actual head in it. So yeah, it's one of those things where it's interesting to see how he's playing it, and just like the fact that they're not reacting is like, whew, he got away again, you know?
Yeah, and it's the whole thing of the how much that they're letting on that they know it. Again, it's they know when to do it, so that they make sure how he doesn't clock on that they know it's him.
Yeah, exactly. It's very covert, but and they're. I don't know. It's so fun to see. And this is why I think this is one of those movies that really, it's that much more enjoyable to revisit, because you can really kind of get a sense as to how they're all acting, knowing that this is this person. But just like, whatever, we're doing our thing and he's playing his part and we're just going to kind of go along with it. And I think that's what, almost in later viewings, it makes it that much more creepy that they're just so casual letting him kind of go along with this, with thinking that he's onto them, you know?
Yeah, and then, again, that's all part of why it has that creepy and unsettling vibe to it, is just how nonchalant everyone plays it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, then moving on through the scene, we then get walk towards the beach, and the person in the hobby horse costume taking it off because we've seen the path the hobby horse clearly wouldn't fit.
This is a big costume.
Yeah, but then when we actually get to the beach, actually, an interesting behind the scenes detail is that the original intention was for the sword dance and the circle to be in on the beach rather than the stone circle.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and it ended up changing during filming, I think, for the better, since, again, like I said, the stone circle, it fits better with the vibe they're going for with that specific ritual.
Well, and there's an element also that makes the ritual and the whole procession and everything involved feel so much grander in scope when it's not just like in one location. Like, it's this thing that really feels like we're doing this over the course of a day or a whole like afternoon or however long it is. Like, we really are kind of, we go here and we do this whole thing, and then we all march to the sea and we do this whole thing, and like, it feels like there's so much more to it than if it was just all here in one location.
Again, it works in establishing that this is the clear ritual that they have. The sword dance, and then they go down to the beach and send the beer into the ocean. And I also like how you can actually see the beer foaming up on as it's that gets washed back onto the shore.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's one of those. It is one of those sad things, and to see those barrels roll. But yeah, it is one of those things that you do notice, and it just makes me wonder, like, how quickly that dilutes in the water there. But yeah, there's a lot of foam.
Or whether there's some very drunk fish swimming around.
Exactly. And I also just was wondering, like, that getting that. It looks like a Clydesdale that they bring it down there with. It's just like, that's a lot of work, I imagine, for the horse to kind of roll that thing across kind of that rocky shore.
I think where it's all those little details as well, like, you know, we have that horse there, and you know that it's probably only really used in the ritual just for the, like, the transportation of the beer. And when you also tell that they clearly had to arrange it so that they had plenty of time to get the horse there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's obviously like, there is this procession that's going on, but as we get a sense of the story through like these scenes, not everybody is involved in the procession. And I mean, I guess it does make me wonder to a certain extent after, I mean, I guess the sword ritual, it's only a few people who ever end up going through that. It's not like the entire village goes through it. It's just enough people to kind of get through, as you pointed out, really to kind of get through that nursery room rhyme. So we get the beheading. The beheading happens, and then they go to the beach. So it's like, not everybody has to be there. And same thing here. It's like, we've had people doing a lot of other things. Like, obviously, some people missed the procession entirely because they had to get the beer down here, and they are all dealing with rowing up the cave.
And it's all those little, like, admin-y bits that you're thinking of how the logistics of everything and how they've clearly fought through it all. It's those details that I really like thinking about in films like this.
Yeah, because clearly, well, and again, I think it just goes to show the scope of this being a community event and this entire ritual that we've started. Like, once he kind of dons the costume, he's really like, we're entering that act of the film where we're going to be in this procession, and this is really where we get a sense as to just how far this community has gone down the road of these rituals and everything. And we see, yeah, it really is everybody is involved in this thing, and he is the lone person here. And at this point, you know, he's kind of thinking, okay, Rowan is, you know, somebody who is being used by this group. Everybody else, though, is looking to sacrifice her. And so they do set it up as soon as he gets down there, and you see these people all standing at the entrance to the cave
with the torches.
Yeah, you realize, wow, okay, this is pretty terrifying. Like, there is really kind of no hope for this little girl.
Yeah, and you can see how it's leading to how he thinks his big hero moment, going up, punching out the people holding Rowan and rescuing her, going through the cave. You see how he thinks, this is my hero moment. I've not been crazy, I've known Rowan's real, and I can get her to safety.
I have so many thoughts about him as a police officer through this section of the film, because it's like, I think he's incredibly proactive at this particular point, and I love to see that he's actively trying to do something, even though I do wonder where he thinks he's going to get to. And like, it's an, like, he's very proactive until he's kind of caught, and then he's completely inert. And I do wonder, I like seeing that he's proactive. Like, I like him doing the police work. I like that he jumps to action so quickly as soon as he sees her and runs and tries to put a plan in place. Although it does make me wonder, his plane is broken. He has no way to communicate. And so, like, what is his plan at this point? Like, I really wonder what he's hoping to achieve other than, you know, I guess just saving Rowan. But then even after the reveal that we have here in a minute, like, what are his plans at that point? Like, should he be more proactive then? And I mean, I don't know. If it were me, I'm like, hell, do I just go jump in the ocean and try to swim? Like, what do I do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things where a lot of things to do with how he throughout the film, he feels like he acts before he thinks. Not really.
Yeah, right.
He feels like because he's the one doing it, he's in the right in all times.
Well, and that, you know, I think also, you know, that leads to kind of a question earlier in the film when he makes the decision to knock out the guy and take the costume, which of course happens to be the fool. Like, was that all purposefully set up in such a way? And you probably talked about this, but in the hopes that, okay, we have to put him in a situation where he's going to try to disguise himself. So we need to make sure that he's close to the full costume and hopefully he'll take it from you. Because it really relies on Sergeant Howie to kind of go through this process. And obviously he does exactly what they were wanting, but in the scope of him, like, of all of the machinations that they go through setting all of this situation up, it is one of those lucky breaks that they had that he kind of goes through this. And through all of this, like, he really, I don't know, I guess I find it so interesting. And that's one of those elements of the film when you're looking at, like, this pagan ritual. Are we meant to believe as an audience that there is something actually at work here that's kind of leading him down the path to actually do all of the things that they're needing him to do?
And it's just one, I've talked about it earlier with about the Hand of Glory and was on McGregor and the costume, but it's the whole thing of the question of, and throughout the film, of how much of it is like a genuine belief or genuine acts of pagans in their religion, or and how much of it is just dumb luck.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like there's quite a bit of that. But again, that's one of the things that I think I kind of find leads to that sense of dread with this film, that they put this person into this situation in the hopes that everything will line up so that they can get him where he needs to be. And it just makes me wonder if there's this, I don't know, it adds to that sense of dread. Like, if I happened to be in a situation like this, what sort of decisions would I be making on my own that I thought were my own decisions without realizing, oh, they actually had been playing me? Right. I don't know. I find that to actually be, like, add to the terror of this film. Like, they were so sharp in putting this plan together that he walked into every single trap.
And this interesting thing of thinking about how the research they must have done so that they can know exactly what buttons to press up and at what time.
Right, right, exactly. It's I find it to be so interesting because it's over the course of, you know, I don't know, how many days is this? Like, just a few days?
A few days.
Yeah, and everything that they're doing is so well structured to kind of keep pushing him down this and lead him to this place. But I mean, even to the point where it does make you wonder, I mean, obviously they needed this representative from the government to kind of fill this role. But the fact that he also is such a pious man, it does make you wonder, was that something that they lucked into, or was that something that even mattered, or was it something that they were somehow also maneuvering to get very specific,
deliberately choosing
I don't know. I just find it all so fascinating, and it's just the way that he is so active. Like, he just jumps into action as soon as he sees her. Finally, like, all this time he's been looking for her, to the point where he exhumes the grave where supposedly she is. Like, he keeps looking and looking and looking, and finally he sees her, and just boom. Like, he's ready. He jumps into police mode and runs off to save her. And it just, it's like hopeless. Like, why is he doing, like, what is he hoping to achieve? I don't know. I just think it's so interesting, and I think it says so much about who he is as this person who doesn't have a plan, but he knows what he needs to do. And I don't know. I just find it to be, like, this is the only time he's really in a situation where he knows what he needs to do. He jumps into action and he moves forward, because very shortly he's going to be in a situation once Rowan runs off to back to Summer Isle, where he's just like, you know,
pretty much in a state of shock.
Yeah, he's completely unable to act again, and he's just completely bewildered, and all he can do is quote the Bible. It's so fascinating to me. Like, what an interesting character. And I love the way that all of this set up to kind of get this person exactly to this point where they go through this cave and come out the other end and everybody's sitting there waiting for him. It's so interesting.
Yeah, the whole thing of it's also him being in here, it makes him actually much easier to deceive in that moment through Rowan giving him, oh, this is the way out, this is the way out, and they say how he is, they can just lead how he right to Summer Isle, or know exactly where they need to take him.
Yeah. No, it's such an interesting way that all of this plays. I find it to be such a fascinating film. I always wonder, how does Summer Isle get here so quickly and change his clothes? But, you know, I don't know. In my head, I guess what I say is, you know, the run through the cave probably lasts a little longer than we get to see in the film, you know?
I mean, then in terms of changing the clothes, the only real thing changes is taking off the dress and putting on that tweed jacket.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, he had that all set and ready. I just love it.
Well, then a few, like, other interesting things with this, like, with the run through the cave is, firstly, this, according to the book, Inside the Wicker Man, this was one of the scenes that wasn't actually filmed on location in Scotland. It was filmed at the Wookiee Cave in England, in Somerset, which is a bit of a tourist location. Used for filming other things like used for Doctor Who, Blake 7, a few times. Also well known as an ideal location for maturing cheese.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Where, like, if you go deep down in the cave, it's, there's a part of it that's at the right ambient temperature for maturing cheese.
And I suppose that it's one of those things where it's that right temperature year round, so it makes it that much easier. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
But, and then also, one thing I find interesting in this section, when it's on the cave, is the music in it. Because it feels more funky, if that's the right word, than the rest of the music Paul Giovanni did for the film, which has the roots in, like, acoustics and folk music.
There is a little bit of that sense. Yeah, it does kind of suddenly jump into kind of the sort of music that we would get in the 60s and 70s, that very kind of jazzy, funky score. And
you can imagine it being used in, like, a chase scene, something like The Sweeney or The Professionals.
Sure, yeah.
That kind of British detective show.
Yep.
And apparently that was, like, an edict from the studio British Lion, who, like, wanted that more traditional score for the time for that scene in the film, whereas Giovanni's intention was for all acoustic instruments for the entire film.
You know, that's actually interesting, because the music there does always stand out. It doesn't have that same, that folksy Willows song sort of vibe that we have through the film. And it does, in a way, kind of put it into its era. But I suppose because this is that one moment where we do have Sergeant Howie really being,
but he feels he's in the action.
Yeah, he's the action cop, right? And so suddenly it's like, I guess I can see the perspective of saying this is the moment where he is actually playing the cop in that TV show, and he's actually doing his job, and he's like, the one moment that he actually is succeeding, you know?
Or he feels that he's succeeding.
Or, yeah, more appropriate, exactly.
And then that gets us into the final section of this scene of the film, which is the big reveal of, you know, how he and Rowan get out of the cave, and they're right next to Summer Isle. And Rowan, see that smile creep up on Roman's face. And I have to give massive credit to the performance of Jerry Cowper playing Rowan for knowing that it's a scared feel when Harry first rescues her, but also knowing not to give the game away until that moment when she gives that smile and that and says, did she do it right?
Yeah.
And then runs into Summer Isle's arms.
Also, like, that I think continues the feel of creating this world, because like there's a difference with like adults being deceptive, the way that is kind of going on with this, the kind of this whole cult on this island. But when you get one of these kids who's doing it, like, you know, kids, I think it's much harder for them to kind of lie and be as deceitful. But when you see her doing it, like, you realize that she's so sucked into the beliefs of this world that that she is just seeing it as playing this part. And it's, I don't know, I think that it's all the more creepy when you realize even the kids are so, like, they so buy into everything going on here. And I think that her line to Summer Isle right there, that really says it all. Like, did I do it right? It's, you know, it's that speaks to that kind of that brainwashing that these people do with their young
names.
Yeah.
And also why it works really well that, I don't know if you noticed, that Miss Rose is in that scene as well.
Yeah, right. Yep. Which, I don't know. All of it, I think, is, it just lends to the way that these people kind of build this community. And it's just, I mean, it's just all the more terrifying when you see how fully bought in they all are. All the way down to the little...
I don't think where... Yeah, it just works in some, like, the cult's atmosphere of the film. And again, when you rewatch it, and knowing that the twist is coming on and how that all the kids are playing it throughout the film, and it's really interesting to think about how all the clues that you can see of that, it's all deliberate trap that you don't necessarily pick up on the first time you watch the film.
Yeah, like everything from the desk and the attendance records and like everything, like the picture, like it's all so set up. And it's, that's what's so fascinating about the film. Again, having it be a policeman, having, you know, as the representative of the king and all that sort of thing, everything is so meticulously plotted with all of this that it just, I don't know, it's just so, it makes it all the more terrifying. Because you start getting a sense as to how you could stumble upon a community like this. Like, I mean, maybe not on a little island like this, but just driving through a town or something. And you just end up in a place where everybody kind of is in something like this. And you end up being the unwitting sap that they sucker into doing all of this. Like, it's, I think that's what makes for such fascinating horror stories, because it just doesn't feel, it's not, you know, just like this bloodletting kind of, you know, horror like, you know, sort of film. It's just, it's so summery and creepy.
Yeah, and it's, I think that helps make folk horror like kind of work really well as this, as the subgenre, in that you get these vibes and new feels of folk horror that you don't really get with other kinds of horror.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that's why films like this and Midsommar and any of those sorts of films, they build this tone that you just, it's really difficult to ever feel like you could figure out how to escape if you ended up in this place.
Yeah, it's that all unsettling undercurrent of the film.
Oh God, it's through the whole thing. Like, it just, it's constant in this film. This is why it's so effective, because it's really not until we're in this section of the film where you realize it's everybody. Like, earlier in the film, you're like, okay, some of these people are weird because they're in a small town, but there's a few people where I have a suspicion that something's going on. Somebody knows what happened to this little girl, and they're just not talking. I got to figure out who that is. And it's really not until this point. And this is why, God, I would love to have that memory back as to like my impressions of the first time I watched this. I feel like when I first saw this, I feel like somebody already had spoiled it for me. Like, you know, this island, they all catch him and they burn him in the Wicker Man. Like, I feel like it had been spoiled. But I just like watching this for the first time and just getting the sense that, holy cow, it's everybody. Like, that to me, I think, is just one of the most terrifying things, because it's like, it's hopeless.
Yeah, and as you see, like, in the next few segments, there is no escape. Once Howie's been led to this point, he's dead.
Yeah. Yep. So scary. And so, it just, yeah, it's such a visually terrifying way to go too.
So, do you have any other thoughts on the Wicker Man or and this scene in particular?
You know, I just, other than this is a movie that every time I watch it, I remind myself, I need to watch this more often. Like, I should watch this just every May Day, because it would be such a fun film to watch. Like, there are those certain films that are fun to watch certain times of year, you know, like Groundhog Day, or there's what other ones? Like, I mean, there's plenty for Halloween or Thanksgiving or back other holidays. Back to the Future 2, right? Exactly. And so this is one of those that I need to view more often and put it on every May Day, because it's just every time I watch it, I'm like, this is such an unsettling film, and absolutely is one that people should check out, certainly if they haven't seen it. I'm assuming if they're listening to this podcast that they've seen it and are fans. but it's definitely a film that is, I don't know, it just creates a sense of place that, and it is so isolated too, this little community, that I don't know, I find it to be incredibly effective and definitely worth revisiting.
Okay, and then with that comes the end of episode 15. Andy, I'd like to thank you again for being my guest on this podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled that that you put the word out and that I got a chance to talk with you about it.
Yeah, and before we sign off, is there anything that you want to plug?
You know, people can check out, we've got a Movies by Minutes podcast. It's a little less, I don't know, it's the Marvel Movie Minute. We're breaking down the films of the Marvel Cinematic Universe 1 minute at a time. You know, it's a little more pop culture, goofy fun, but we're having a good time with that. And then I have another podcast, The Next Reel, and that's just a straight up movie podcast. We've been doing that since 2011, and we just talk about a different movie each week in different series that we build. We just are starting recording the Mission Impossible series, getting ready for Dead Reckoning coming out this summer. So, you can look both of those up, thenextreel.com or marvelmovieminute.com, and you can learn more and find them on your podcatchers.
Yeah, and then for me, outside of this podcast, you find my main review site over at coogsreviews.wordpress.com, and on social media, Twitter at Tony Coogs and Instagram at Coog and Tony. Andy, thanks again for being on this episode.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And everyone listening, I'll speak to you again next time.